Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to the seventh episode of the Calcioland Podcast. I want to begin, as always, by thanking you for your support. We've had a great run of reviews. We've expanded the types of guests that we have on the show. And none of this would happen without your support. So I want to begin by thanking you for that. So I'm once again joined by our excellent producer, Alex Goldberg. So Alex, I'm going to take you down a trip down memory lane to our first preview episode, where I mentioned that the most important thing for Serie A to go back to its glory days is for Milan to be relevant again. Do you remember that conversation that we had?
David, not to be corny, but I remember it like it was yesterday. The preview episode, I can't believe, is so far in the distance. But, you know, I've been watching all the rumors about AC Milan on your Twitter account, and I've been very impressed with who they've been linked to. Andrea Conti, Alvaro Morata, Frank Kessie, and even Raja Nainggolan, who all have been linked to my Chelsea, by the way. So what else is going on there with AC Milan?
So I have to tell you, I was a little bit reticent to do more Milan talk because we've done a lot of it. Our first real episode was with Matteo Bonetti. The past few weeks, we always talk about Milan's transfer. But you know what? I can't get enough of it because the last few years have been so rough with Milan between free transfers, desperate loans at the last minute. So because I'm such a fan of Serie A, like, I'm excited to talk about Milan, and I know many of the people listening are too. So let's talk a little bit about some players at Milan. This week, we saw Milan's Twitter account with all the pictures on Musacchio. That deal is going to become official very soon. Musacchio is going to be a very good partner for Romagnoli on the defense. Then we have Frank Kessie, who was linked to, like we talked about, Chelsea, but also Manchester United, Paris Saint-Germain, like a very intriguing midfielder. So that's going to be probably the next addition as well. Conti is a very exciting right back who plays for Atalanta now. He would be quite the get for Milan, and they've been talking to Atalanta about Kessie, so hopefully there's a fit there as well. Two players that I find, though, very interesting for Milan are players that are currently at Lazio. So we have midfielder Lucas Biglia, who has been trying to negotiate a new contract with Lazio, but because of Milan's interest, he's kind of pondering that. He's had opportunities in the past to leave Lazio for bigger clubs, some in the Premier League. He's a player that for a while fairly regularly started for Argentina. And just the fact that he's considering leaving Lazio for Milan says a lot about Milan's improvement on the transfer market. So Lazio, I would say, has a pretty good relationship with Milan, which on paper would also help them for the signing of Kita Balde. It was a very exciting prospect, winger. More than a prospect, because he's had an unbelievable season for Lazio. I think he's been one of the best wingers in Serie A. But what I find interesting is, if I was in Lazio's shoes, if you see, if say Biglia goes to Milan, would they also want to sell Kita to Milan, considering that that's a team that is going to be competing with them for one of those spots in the Champions League? And Juve is very hard in their pursuit for Kita. He has just 1 year left on his contract, so he has a lot of leverage to decide what team he could be on next. He could just refuse transfer moves to another club and tell Lazio, I'll just stay here, and then in January of next year, I can sign with Juve for next season. So I'm very interested to see how that situation develops with that. But I will say this, you know, we always like to talk about conspiracy theories on our show. Sometimes I like to laugh off conspiracy theories that people tweet me about transfer rumors. I like to have my own conspiracy theory sometimes. So just indulge me for a second. It's in the back of my mind that I really hope that all this activity that we see with Milan isn't going to be potentially financed with a sale of Gigio Donnarumma, which I think would be really devastating. You know, in a way, we saw it a little bit with Juve last summer, where, you know, they went for Higuain, went for Pjanic, and then before you knew it, Pogba was on his way to Manchester United. So I don't want to rain on the parade of Milan fans. Please don't think that, but that's just how my mind works. Let's just hope that Milan's just going to sign all these players, because all this early activity, I think, is going to help convince Donnarumma and his agent, Mino Raiola, that Milan's on the right track and they're the team for them to stick around to long term.
Well, it really is great to see, you know, Milan trying to make a comeback and go right back to the top. But let's look at who's at the top, the defending champs Juventus. What are they doing on the market?
So, you know, a lot of Juve fans, what I always find interesting is Juve fans are always asking me, they throw me a ton of names and all. But, you know, I'm a big fan of the theory of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, I look at Juve with the new formation that they've been using. Today, Mandzukic signed an extension. I can't think of a player that deserved an extension more. If you are, you know, just someone that looks that he's listed as a striker, you look at his goal and assist total, you're like, oh, this guy's not even that good. But if you watch Juve, I mean, this is the guy that to me is the glue to the team. He's technically a winger now in Allegri's formation, but the guy's everywhere on the pitch. Like, his work rate is second to none. So in my opinion, Juve really should just like stick to this group as much as possible. I think their priority is really keeping what they have. But Juve also is looking at some young players to build for the future. So we mentioned Kita Balde, who I think, you know, long term could replace Mandzukic very well as the winger, and he could have some space in the meantime. One player that I think they're going to sign this summer is Mattia De Ciglio, who's the right back from Milan that can play on the left as well. You know, it wasn't that long ago that De Ciglio was being called the new Maldini. And look, if you think about what Allegri's brand was at Milan when he left, or even Pirlo, I could see Juve thinking, you know what, those two came from Milan. That worked out pretty well. Maybe we can keep it going with De Ciglio as well. So I know on paper right now, De Ciglio has had some down seasons, but I think it makes a lot of sense for Juve to target him because there's two right backs, Lichtsteiner and Dani Alves, or, you know, especially Dani Alves is in his mid-30s. Lichtsteiner, I think, is 32. So that makes a lot of sense for them. I think what's really changed a lot of Juve plans is that formation change as well. They had pretty much reserved Tolisso, fantastic midfielder from Lyon. You know, Juve fans always drooling about Verratti, and I'm always telling them, you know what, Tolisso is not just a great consolation prize. That's really a great player. Reminds me a lot about Vidal. But the formation change, I think, makes him a little bit less of a priority. If you think about it, Juve already has Marchisio on the bench because Khedira and Pjanic have been working really well there in the midfield behind Dybala, Cuadrado, and Mandzukic. So I think Tolisso is a little bit less of a priority. Juve's still kicking the tires around that. Another player is Fabinho, who plays for Monaco, but both clubs in Manchester definitely need him more than Juve and could spend crazy money on him. But a player that Juve is very interested in is Patrick Schick, who is at Sampdoria, striker. He's been linked to all the top teams in Europe, and now Borussia Dortmund is going after him as well. I could see Juve following the blueprint of the Caldara signing. They signed him in January, going to leave him at Atalanta for one more season so he can play regularly in a system that he's familiar with. And I think Juve, in an ideal world, is going to do the same with Schick. But I think Juve fans, rather than sending me all these questions on buying all these players, like, enjoy the team that you have. It's great if they can just keep what they have and add some young players to keep the success going in the next few years. So now that we got the intro out of the way, let's get to your questions. I really enjoy when you guys send in excellent questions. Please do so using the CalcioLand hashtag. So, Alex, which ones did you pick for tonight?
All right, so the first one, you'll be happy to know, involves two different Italian players. It's kind of a two-part question, but here it goes. Where should Mario Balotelli play next season? And then, will Barcelona realize Verratti is the player they need?
So let's begin with Balotelli. People who know me a little bit are aware of the fact that there's a big part of my heart for Balotelli. Just like him, I was a foreigner growing up in Italy, and I've always related to him for that. I've forgiven a lot of his misdeeds because of it. And I think, you know, for the most part, he's had a good bounce back season at Nice. You know, he has an expiring contract. I could see a team in Italy taking a flyer on him, and I'd be very interested to see Balotelli on a team like Sampdoria. I think that would make a lot of sense for him. Sampdoria has done well with reclamation projects. 1 year, Cassano did well there. Quagliarella's done very well for them. Maybe doesn't get that much credit because they have Muriel and Sheik. So that would be an intriguing team for them. Sampdoria's president, Ferrero, is quite an eccentric character that works in the movie business. I think he would love the buzz that comes with Balotelli. And another club that I could see is Bologna. And a lot of you hearing this are probably like, Bologna, but does that make any sense? If you look at Bologna's history, they've had big-name Italian strikers looking to bounce back or towards the end of their career. They've had Roberto Baggio. They've had Signori there. And they have an owner, Joey Saputo, who has the club in Montreal as well, has been, you know, very ambitious there. So those are two clubs off the top of my head that I would like to see him at. Can never count out Napoli as well, but they're pretty stacked up front. Balotelli is always a big Milan fan, but they seem to have other targets. But I'd be very intrigued to see Balotelli back in Serie A. As far as Verratti, we've talked a little bit about him in the past. I mean, sure, Barcelona, that makes so much sense on paper. They've missed a midfielder like that since Xavi, you know, with his career ended and he left the Cub. Iniesta now is dropping hints that he might not extend his contract there, and you could see Juve really trying to make that happen. So on paper, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, but people just need to realize that PSG, they do not let their best players leave. You know, Ibrahimovic, Matuidi both had Raiola as their agent. Rumors of them leaving, they end up staying. Verratti keeps signing extensions to stay there. Really enjoys his life in Paris. So while on paper it makes a lot of sense, I'd be very surprised to see Verratti leaving PSG.
Okay. So this next one, I am sure your Twitter timeline and notifications are just blowing up your phone because, you know, this is the hot button one. Does Manchester United winning Europa League and qualifying for the Champions League next year increase their chances of landing Antoine Griezmann?
I'll tell you what, Alex. I think in a way, I kind of shot myself in the foot. You know, sometimes I love doing banter on Twitter. And at the end of last summer's transfer window, after the Mourinho, the Pogba sagas, which, you know, like held my Twitter TL hostage, I jokingly sent a tweet to Griezmann when he congratulated Pogba on going to Manchester United. I tweeted him, you know what? We can't wait to answer a million questions about you just like we did with Pogba this summer. So you know what? I deserve it. You guys keep bombarding me with Griezmann. And Griezmann likes to talk a lot. He's got an intriguing personality. And he was on French TV earlier this week, and when he was asked about Manchester United, he left the door wide open. He said, "We'll know in 2 weeks. There might be some changes in my future." And when the host asked him, "What about Manchester United on a scale of 1 to 10? He said 6. Pretty intriguing. Later in the interview, though, he was asked, "What are the odds of you staying at Atletico Madrid?" He said 7. So it sounds like Griezmann's math isn't that great to begin with, but, you know, he left the door open. But, you know, one thing, you know, in general, I don't put much stock in what players, agents, presidents, coaches say about transfers publicly. Just not that important to me. And I always try to figure out who are they talking to. I have a hard time believing that Griezmann would have answered that question if he was talking to the Spanish press or Spanish press that's tied to Atletico Madrid. He left that door open, and more recently, though, he made quotes about staying at Atletico Madrid. So definitely the Europa League, though, Manchester United winning the Europa League certainly helps. Griezmann has said that he wants to play in the Champions League, and because Man United won the Europa League, they'll be in the Champions League. So that certainly helps a lot. But there are also some other factors in that. Simeone staying at Atletico Madrid helps the case for Griezmann staying there. The two of them have a very strong bond. The other thing, too, is Atletico Madrid is trying to reverse their transfer ban for this summer. That could help or hurt them, because if the transfer ban is overturned, they could sign Lacazette from Lyon. He could either replace Griezmann, or Griezmann could say, "Hey, I could play with my buddy here rather than Pogba at Manchester United." So it definitely helps that Manchester United won, but let's take a look at what happens with the appeal for Atletico Madrid for their transfer ban.
Okay, interesting. All right, this next player is also a very highly rumored player. I still wish he would come to my club, Chelsea. But is there any truth to Raja Nainggolan to AC Milan?
So I had a good time with this one. So Di Marzio, a couple of days ago, tweeted about Milan and Nainggolan. And, you know, in Italian, I forget the exact words, but he wrote Milan's impossible dream of Raja Nainggolan. And people, of course, ignored that impossible dream part. Very few people actually read the articles. And please, guys, instead of asking me a question, just read the articles, because they're short. Most of the time, the answer's there. But in any event, the article also said that Milan would make an attempt to sign Nainggolan only if he can extend his contract with Roma and if he shows willingness to play for another club in Italy. Look, I can't blame Milan for trying to sign Nainggolan. Any club should want a player of that caliber. But just because a club is interested, it's Di Marzio's job or anyone that covers transfers to report that. So kudos for Milan for having that type of ambition. I'm not sure how realistic it is, but again, the interest of a club like Milan and a player like Nainggolan is news, and that needs to be reported.
Okay. So this next Twitter question, I remember asking you a few years ago, and you know, now finally maybe it's time. Do you think Sassuolo winger Domenico Berardi will make a move to a big club?
So Berardi is a very interesting player. I think a few months ago I wrote a column that it wouldn't surprise me if Berardi's career arc ends up following Totò Di Natale, who was linked to so many big clubs but was much more comfortable playing at an Italy we would call a provincial club, not earning as much, but you know, not having to deal with the pressure of a big club. And Berardi, you know, kind of has an odd character. He had many opportunities to go to Juve, always turned it down. You could say that's because, you know, he grew up as an Inter fan. You know, it's hard to say. In general, I don't think the team you support is that important for players. Look, Maldini grew up a Juve fan. Pirlo grew up an Inter fan. It depends, but for some players, it might actually matter. But I think more than that, it's really Berardi's personality. His current coach at Sassuolo, Di Francesco, described him as introverted and shy. I'm not sure he has the personality for a big club, but that might change. And interestingly, his current manager, Di Francesco, is very likely going to be Roma's new coach. Wouldn't surprise me if Berardi wants to follow him there. I also could see Inter making a push for him, especially if they sell Ivan Perisic, which looks pretty likely this summer. So I'm going to say that there's a decent chance that Berardi leaves. On the other hand, with the World Cup coming, he's definitely young enough that he can wait a year and just try to prove himself so he can make the World Cup squad. But more than in years past, I think there's a chance that he might leave this summer.
Okay. Next one, will Jose Mourinho return to Inter someday?
Great question. So it was interesting because somebody asked me this on Twitter and I said, yeah, it's possible. And right away, Manchester United fans, this was right after they won the Europa League, like just jumped on my tail saying, what are you talking about? Blah, 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 blah. So, you know, Mourinho loved his time at Inter. He won the treble there. He's beloved at the club. People just always underestimate Inter's appeal as a club. The fact that they're based in a city like Milano definitely helps them. They have huge financial resources. I could see it. It won't be anytime soon. But Inter always seems to have a sentimental value to coaches like Simeone as well. So I won't exclude it. I don't think it'll be anytime soon. But I could see Mourinho in a few years going there.
All right. Last Twitter question. Thoughts on Gattuso coaching Milan's Primavera, and will his personality help or hurt the young players?
So let me begin by saying that I'm a huge fan of Rino Gattuso. When I think of the 2006 World Cup team, the Italian team that won the World Cup, there's few teams that I love more. Gattuso was just like so incredible on that team. I love his personality. I love writing articles on his quotes because he's always so colorful. But I'll tell you this. I think former players, it's so easy to overrate them as managers because of their big name. Gattuso, you know, was managing Pisa and Serie B this season. They were relegated. You know, they had a tough situation at the club. They looked like they were going to be sold and then weren't. So it was a tough situation. But it's not like he's a very established coach either. Let's also remember Pippo Inzaghi promoted from the Primavera team at Milan to the senior squad. That about being a disaster. So, you know, maybe if Gattuso goes to Milan's Primavera, so the most senior squad and the youth system, he could do well and kind of earn his way up. So let's see how that goes. But I also really want to caution fans, don't overrate a former player as a manager just because they're a big name. And also Gattuso, you look at his demeanor, his personality, like his ferocity, his grinta, as we would call it in Italy, sometimes that doesn't translate very well to managing. Like, as fans, we're like, we want a manager that just pushes his players and tell them, come on, and punches them in the face when they need it. But you know what? Sometimes that doesn't work either. But you know what? Let's put those things aside. I really hope Gattuso ends up becoming a great coach. Okay, guys, and so for my favorite part of the show is the interview part, because I get to learn, I get to have a conversation with interesting people in the world of football. And today I hope you guys don't mind if I'm going to refer to the sport as soccer a few times, and I think you guys will see why. So today we are joined by Charles Stelletano, who is the co-founder and chairman of Relevant Sports, who are the organizer of the International Championship Cup, which is a huge tournament that's going to take place here in the United States between July 18th and July 30th. There's some great teams involved. I think many of you listening are aware of this, but we're going to have Real Madrid, Juve, Paris Saint-Germain, Manchester United, Barcelona, Manchester City, Tottenham, and Roma playing here in the United States. So really, really excited to learn more about this tournament. But our guest, Charlie, also has a very impressive career. He was one of the first general managers in MLS back in the 90s. He actually was one of the organizers of, he contributed to organizing the World Cup in the United States in 1994. And he's also a co-host of the football show on Sirius XM. So we're thrilled to have you on the show, Charlie, and welcome to Calcioland.
Thank you so much, David. It's really my pleasure.
Fantastic. So before we talk about the tournament, which is a big interest to all our listeners, I want to tell your story. I've been researching you since yesterday, and I stumbled upon a lot of fascinating things that I wanted to ask you about. So a friend of the show, Grant Wall, has referred to you as World Soccer Best Connected American. You are friends with a lot of great characters in the world of football in Europe. And I want to start with Jose Mourinho, because yesterday Mourinho won the Europa League with Manchester United. And Mourinho has a very cool nickname, the special one, but he gave you an even cooler nickname, Mr. Zero Mistakes. So tell us a little bit how you got to know Mao and how you earned this great nickname.
Well, I mean, it's first of all, it's completely over the top. It's very nice to him. That just shows you he's my friend. But you know, I've known Jose Mourinho since 2004 when we brought over Chelsea for the first time. And it's funny because another dear friend of mine, Sir Alex Ferguson, said the exact same thing to me that Jose said the first time they met me. And it says a little bit about the men. I was in Singapore in 1999, 2000, I think it was, and we were playing golf with Manchester United. We were there for their tour, and the ball came over onto my tee box. I'm not a very good golfer, but obviously this guy wasn't either, from a different green, right? And he turns out it's Sir Alex Ferguson. So I say to him, Mr. Ferguson, he was Mr. Ferguson at the time. I guess it was 98.
Okay.
So I said, Mr. Ferguson, I'm Charlie Stelletano. I'm handling your tour in the States. And he said, before I could say a word, I handed him the ball. He said, I know who you are. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, fast forward 2006 or 2004, I'm in Philadelphia at the Four Seasons. Chelsea's there. I walk up to, hello, Mr. Mourinho, and introduce myself. And before I could say my name's Charlie Stelletano, he goes, I know who you are. And so I just said, but it says a lot about these guys. They do their homework. They're really, really precise about everything they do. And they let you know it when they're not happy. And so really what I've done for Jose in particular is just try to do what he wants. Try to create a a preseason tournament for him that can prepare his team and then gives him the opportunity to compare prepare the team best he can. And he's done a great job with that. In fact, Sir Alex Ferguson said he learned from Jose Mourinho that you really need to start out fast in the Premier League if you want to win it.
Yeah.
And he's the guy that showed him the way that, you know, these preseason tournaments can be really helpful for the team and help prepare them.
Excellent. So I really enjoyed the research that I did. It was mainly an article that Grant Wall wrote about you. And I love the stories of Mourinho and Ferguson coming to eat at your house. And also tell us a little bit about who's the most demanding when it comes to having the best food.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good one. I think probably Jose's more perceptive, but Sir Alex is more demanding. And he will be the first to tell you. The other one who's probably the most demanding is Carlo Ancelotti.
Oh, okay.
He's the most demanding because, you know, I only cook Italian food and Southern barbecue. And Carlo is obviously an aficionado of Italian food.
Yeah.
And so he's the most critical. He's the one who'll tell you even if the cheese isn't perfect, you know. So something that I don't make my own cheese, of course. But he will even criticize that. Sir Alex probably is more, no, I guess he's just as critical as Carlo when it comes to the wine. Jose, you need to prepare it on time and have it ready for him when he wants to eat.
Fantastic.
How's that?
That's a great answer. So before we get to the tournament, let's take a step back because I was very interested in reading about your career. So I think, you know, I grew up in Italy, but my family is based in the U.S., so I came here often. And before 94, you know, soccer was really a niche sport here in the U.S. And I think the 94 World Cup was really the beginning of the rise of soccer, as we call it here in the United States. And I can't help but notice a lot of parallels between the sport and your career, because you started then after being the organizer, and I think you were in New York at the old Giant Stadium, the games there. Is that correct? And then
absolutely.
And then you were one of the first general managers of the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars, which are no longer an MLS. And the sport has really grown here in the United States. And, you know, when I think of where soccer's going here in the U.S., I think it's really going to go up for a few reasons. I think, you know, the fact that it's just a two-hour game, no commercial breaks, people really enjoy that. I think people just don't have the attention span for baseball that much anymore. I think all the concussions in football, I think there's a great opportunity for soccer to grow. So I want to get your perspective on that. I think your tournament and your work has been instrumental in that. But where do you see the sport growing here in the United States?
Well, David, I think you hit it on the head. When I took over as the venue executive director for Giant Stadium in 1992, I was a young kid, fresh out of sort of law school and a couple years under my belt. I had played actually with Bob Bradley at Princeton University, where I'm proud to say I was an All-American and a captain of the Princeton team. And I always had a love for soccer. And my dad and all his cronies from Italy started the Italian-American Soccer League, brought teams over here. And I was really, really fortunate enough to be named the venue director and have Italy in our backyard. And so, you know, I grew up with the game, watching the game on TV, watching half a game, because that's all they used to give us on the old UHF station.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing back when even Maldini's first game in 1986, because he came in the second half, and they would only show the second half there. So, you know, soccer has come a long, long way. And what people forget is even in 1992, 94, I thought that, you know, none of us knew whether or not it was going to make it or not. None of us knew whether or not the World Cup would be a success. It's almost comical now when you look back and say, really, come on. You have to know everyone loves big tournaments and things like that. But that really wasn't the case back then. And so, what, you know, except for a few Mexican national team games and maybe when – you know, Italy or Portugal would come up, or England in the Northeast, and you'd see some big crowds. But for the most part, it was not, it was after the Cosmos died in the 70s, you know, early 80s, there's really no soccer, and we weren't sure that it would ever make it. But the 94 World Cup was a great success. I chipped my teeth on that, if you will, got to learn the trade. And so, you know, when you're when you're trying to please managers like Arrigo Sacchi and Bertie Vogts and all these different managers there at the time, you know, you are, you know, under great scrutiny, and you're and I always prided myself in you know, doing the right thing for the managers and for the teams. And, you know, you learn a lot of lessons. You learn lessons by making mistakes, I guess, more than anything. And then I was the first general manager of Metro Stars, which is I brought over Donadoni and Bronco and Coricola. Yeah. Had the great American players, Tab Ramos, Tony Miola, Peter Bermese, who have now, I'm proud to say, are all great coaches in their own right out there. And we would Tab, you know, today qualify for the next round of the World Cup in under 20. So, you know, but it, if I said to you that I knew all along you would make it, I'd be lying to you, because it really has been a labor of love and really pushing a boulder up the hill, you know. And early days in the Metro Stars, we had these big teams come in. I remember Tony Miola fended off Battistuta and the rest of Fiorentina, Ranieri Fiorentina, and he must have saved 40 shots that day. And but they finally broke us down after about the 80th minute, and then they scored four goals in that time period in the last 10 minutes. And if the game had gone out, it might have been 20-0, you know. But lessons learned. You see the guys, fans come and they see their stars. They saw our players, and you know our guys always performed well when they played against the international teams. And so I remember Jose Mancini's last game, Sampdoria. We had the Colombian national team, and I said, you know, this could actually, you know, people are interested in this, and soccer has grown up now where it's no longer just the ethnic people, it's not just our families, you know, David, but the whole, you know, the American kids now have become great fans. So you have the ethnic and the you know, the Americans, and it's really become, you know, really popular. And the one thing I'd say is that not just the European leagues, but even MLS has grown. So, you know, look, it's been a real long haul. And, you know, I always joke and say, like I said, you know, pushing that boulder up the hill, but that's exactly what it was, because it's just now that we're starting to enjoy sort of soccer and not apologizing for it. You know, you said things, you know, I still get some old radio guys or TV guys will ask me questions and say, well, you know, they don't score goals in soccer. And you're like, I call it the J from Modern Family, the older guy, you know, how he thinks about soccer. But there's less and less of these people, and there's more and more people that appreciate the subtlety of the sport and the action that goes on in the sport. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a great ride so far.
Excellent. So to tie into that question, what I find very interesting about the tournament that you've been running is that we see a lot of clubs in Europe like really looking to expand their brand here in the United States and even beyond your tournament, which has definitely been a driver for that. I look at Bayern Munich, who already had an English language account. They have a specific United States Twitter account, and there's more and more clubs realizing the potential that comes with trying to branding here in the United States. So how do you see your tournament growing in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you think it will look like in the next few years?
Well, that's great. I mean, we always try to, you know, push the envelope. And I think you bring up a great point. I think Chelsea was probably the first one that utilized a tournament to push their brand. And they came here 4 to 5 years. They opened up youth academies. They did a deal with Disney. My partner, John Scheinman, was really instrumental in putting that deal together. And, you know, they Chelsea, that was seen as, you know, probably, you know, I'll call it a mid-table, you know, English Premier League team like Everton right now, maybe, let's say. But suddenly they took the opportunity to come to the States and to really, you know, get into the hearts and minds of the kids. And I think a lot of people have seen that example. And the hardest part of our tournament was convincing the teams that they should play against other big teams, because in some ways it's counterintuitive. I remember reading a paper of a Liverpool master's student, and, you know, some of the people would tell you, well, it should all be about us. And I remember bringing Real Madrid versus Roma in 2002, and President Perez, who's still there, Florentino Perez, and we've become dear friends, that I'll never bring my team here again because half the stadium was filled with Roma fans back then. And he said, I want it to be about Real Madrid. But what they really, you know, didn't realize back then is what Capello and DeBusk said that day. Capello was the manager of Roma. DeBusk was the manager of Real Madrid. And on the dais was Zidane, Figo, Cassano, Totti, Panucci, Cafu. You know, it was crazy. And some, you know, curmudgeon stood up and said, you know, what's all the big deal about this? It's just a friendly. And I remember Capello saying, no, there's no such thing as a friendly. You put 70,000 people in front of these players, and the players and the fans come to see them. No one wants to be embarrassed.
Sure.
Trust me. There's no such thing as a friendly when you have this. And the boss just shook his head. Yes, you're right. And from there, we had the idea of, you know, if we could create a tournament and bring a little bit of this magic to the U.S., it would be really good. And I really believe that it's helped grow soccer in this country. We've entered into markets where there wasn't soccer before, from Toronto to Seattle. And, you know, MLS teams popped up quickly after that. You know, we've been the first in places like St. Louis and Yankee Stadium. And you see, you know, now they're playing, you know, every week in Yankee Stadium. So, you know, we'd like to think we've contributed a little bit to the growth of the game. And so, you know, that's satisfying when you think in those terms.
Well, I'll say it for you. You definitely had a lot to do with that. So let's talk a little bit about this current edition. So I did a little bit of research and I came up with a lot of great reasons to follow this. So you have the two teams that are going to be in the Champions League final next a week from Saturday.
Yes, we do.
You have the top, my listeners, you know, a lot of them are really into Serie A. You have the top two teams, Juve and Roma. We're going to have Barcelona, which in and of itself is a huge attraction, but they're going to have their new manager coaching their first match at the club. It's almost certainly going to be Ernesto Valverde. So he's going to make his debut at your tournament. And then, of course, without forgetting, we're going to have El Clasico in Miami. We're going to have Barcelona and Real Madrid facing each other on American soil. So that's obviously very impressive. But beyond, you know, just this, what could fans expect if they go to some of these games?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you should realize is that we respect the game a great deal, and the game's the most important part. So we make sure that the game is such where we only allow, you know, there's 11 substitutions, but only three times during a game, for example. So you get to see the stars and you get to see the young emerging stars. You know, Jose Mourinho always talks about that. It's the great place, you know, to play a player, to put him in front of 110,000 people in Michigan is a lot better than putting him at, you know, at Stamford Bridge or the Bernabeu for the first, or Old Trafford now for the first game the guy has to play. And so they use a lot of this as a testing ground, and the senior players use it as a chance to show the fans their appreciation. I remember Cristiano Ronaldo came back from the World Cup and didn't want to, he wasn't supposed to play. This is when Carlo was the manager of Real Madrid. And we were at the big house in Michigan, and it's probably the only place on earth that Cristiano was loved by both teams. Okay, it was Manchester United against Real Madrid, and everyone had a number 7 jersey, either for Real Madrid or Manchester United. And so, what, you know, he wasn't going to play. Carlo said he's not going to play. And about, you know, 10 minutes into the second half, he turned to Carlo and said, I have to come out there. I have to go out there. I have to play. And so what you have is, because of the managers and the players, they've taken this so seriously that they've really created, let's call it, the most important preseason tournament. We're not silly. We realize it's not the Champions League. But when you put these matchups against each other in these beautiful big stadiums and they're packed, the atmosphere is very, very similar to something you would see in a Champions League. And not many people get that opportunity. The second thing that we have is it's much more relaxed between games. So we have open training sessions, you know, the night before in a lot of the stadia. Fans get to come out and literally touch and feel their heroes, get autographs, kids get autographs to see, you know. And so there's a lot that will be doing in and around the games that are really great for the fans.
Fantastic. No, I'm definitely very excited. I plan on going a few games, and I'm very interested to have that full experience. So tell us a little bit. I mean, the roster of teams you have is incredible, but What do you look for in deciding which clubs to invite, and how do you go about enticing them to come play here? Because to me now, soccer has become a sport which is now 365 days a year. Clubs can tour all over the world. A lot of them go to Asia, the Middle East, and get, you know, huge sums of money. So how do you go about picking specific clubs, and how do you convince them to come here?
Well, I think the first and foremost, I'd be lying if I didn't say popularity comes into it. You know, the ideal opponent is someone that's really good and really popular. But the second best thing is to have someone who is an excellent, you know, excellent team, but maybe not be as popular as the other team, but they'll play a big team. So, you know, and, you know, we found that when you have big against big, that it really is, you know, it's almost always spectacular, you know. And so we have five or six huge games, including the one up at Boston this year with Roma and Juve. You know, we have the Manchester Derby in Houston after the terrible tragedy they had. We're going to announce soon we're going to do something for the people of Manchester there. And so there's a lot that goes way beyond soccer. But so it becomes... You know, I remember Jose Mourinho saying on my radio show one day, the World Cup may not be the best soccer in the world, but it's the biggest social event in the world. And, you know, ours is sort of in between. You have great teams, you have a great event where people come together, and you have, you know, great players that get to showcase themselves. So it's a little bit of both worlds that we have, social as well as serious football. So, yeah, I'd like to think that we bring a lot for the fans to come see the games. It's a great opportunity for the fans.
Very, very interesting. So the flip side to that is you have to bring the teams from Europe to come play here. But the other thing you need to do is, you know, get the stadiums, the host cities. Very interesting that you mentioned how you brought this tournament to cities that really didn't have exposure to soccer and now have MLS teams. And some of them have very passionate fan bases now. So how do you go about building those relationships in the host cities and organizing the games with the venues and everything that comes with that?
Well, we've been at it for about 20 years, and so we developed some good relationships with some stadia. You know, people over at MetLife, I've known them since the early 90s, right? So, and a lot of the same people are still there. I mean, I walk around and I'm saying hi and hugging a lot of security guards, you know, so you get to know people over the years. But there are places now with the popularity of the International Champions Cup that actually, you know, visitors conventions bureaus want you and they come after you. And so, you know, we're not at the point where it's, you know, the people are paying you silly money to come, but you get incredible local support from places like, you know, Charlotte, and this year we're in Nashville, where it's remarkable. We've already sold about 45,000 tickets in Nashville, and they're in the middle of this, you know, rabid, you know, hockey team that's going to make it to the Stanley Cup Finals, but they're crazy about this game too. So, you know, I think it's a combination of success breeds success. So if we've done well, cities want us there. They want to see they want to see what we're doing, and they want to bring it into their town and for the community to experience it. So there we go. We're at the airport finally. It brings us to many different opportunities that come up when we're looking at different cities.
Fantastic. I really appreciate your insight into the tournament. And like I said, I'm very excited to definitely go to the game in Boston and likely Juve Barcelona as well. So the last question I have, Charlie, is, you know, a lot of what we do on the podcast, we mainly have journalists. We branched out this week. We had a player's agent where I really appreciate you coming on the show. So I read your story after talking to you. I'm even more intrigued. What could someone like me or someone much younger than me do to one day grow up to become the next Charlie Stiletano, the most connected American guy in soccer? What advice would you, if you could give a young Charlie advice, what would you say?
Well, you know, I think that one thing that I think is very, very important, and this is the same question I ask great managers like Sir Alex and stuff and Jose, and I think there's a degree of humility that comes into it. And I think you have to keep your feet on the ground. You have to be humble. You have to work hard. You know, in our business, you can't be afraid to grab the towels and do what you have to do. But I think the most important thing is persistence, because at the end of the day, at the end of the day, there's a lot of people, especially over the years, that didn't like soccer. And you know, and there's a lot of people that now that soccer's popular want their, you know, they want to be in charge of different things. So I think the best thing to do is work hard, stay humble, and be persistent. And, you know, you'll be successful.
I think that applies to any field, and that's really terrific advice. So, Charlie, thank you so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate it. As the tournament gets closer, if there's anything else we can do to help promote it, because I think fans here in the U.S. should really attend this. I think tonight you gave us a lot more reasons than I even knew coming into the interview. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so let's close it out with a little bit of pop culture mixed in to football. So I always like to say, you know, if someone that failed as a music critic and as a backup, you know, is pretending to be a football pundit. So last weekend, I went to see Metallica Gillette Stadium here around outside Boston. And that concert inspired me a lot. I had to write a column on Inter's transfer window this summer. And, you know, I had it pretty much ready before the concert. And I went there, and the first song was about being hardwired to self-destruct. And that pretty much sums up Inter the past few years. So I decided to change the column a little bit and incorporate that in. But another way, another thing that made me think about Italian football with Metallica is the parallels between Metallica and Juventus. And the reason I say that is Metallica has been at the top for a very long time. I think, you know, they're probably going to end up being the most famous heavy metal band ever. Definitely the most successful. They've been at the top of their game for a very long time. You know, Juve hasn't been at the top for 20 years in Serie A, but I'm sure for a lot of their haters, it feels that way. So I think there's a lot of parallels there. You know, I get it. If you're not a Juve fan, you know, in Italy, we like to say Juve is the team that has the most fans, but also the most haters. So I get it. But, you know, you also have to appreciate the way Juve's run. And for me, the same goes with Metallica. Those guys are just absolutely professional. Playing that type of music at their age is certainly not easy to do. They put on a great show for 2 hours. And, you know, it makes me think a lot about the parallels with Juve. When you're at the top, people are always going to hate. Unfortunately, that's how it is. But I think, you know, a lot of you should just take a step back and at least appreciate the way Juve is run. Everything they do on the transfer market makes sense. They're not afraid to let players go if they want to leave. Same with Metallica. They changed bass players one time because of death, another time because the bass player wanted to go. It's made it happen, and they truck on. So, you know, you want to call me a homer, a fanboy for praising Juve? You want to say that I'm biased? Fine, go ahead. But I'll tell you this. If you don't appreciate the way Juve is run, the one who's biased is you. And thank you for listening.